This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver
Commercial
Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to the Vancouver Commercial Real Estate Podcast. I'm Corey Wright. And on the program today, we have Ryan Wong and Tony Liu from Wong and Liu Appraisers joining us on today's program. Ryan's been on the program in the past, but today we're going to unpack 2025 so far. We're recording this on Halloween, October 31st. I'm going to hopefully be predicting the future here by the time the listeners hear this, that the Jays have won the championship tonight. But we're unpacking 2025, asset classes, what they're seeing on the front lines. And one thing a lot of people don't realize is just how much work they do that's not attached to a contract of purchase and sale. So there's lots of insight from them. Without further ado, let's get to our program today with Ryan Wong and Tony Liu of Wong and Liu. Take care, guys.
This podcast is presented by Impact Commercial.
Impact Commercial, John, Alan, the team over there are fantastic. They've all been on the show.
They have, yeah.
Friends of the show.
Great guys.
Wealth of experience. They can help with all your commercial financing needs.
Whether it's owner-occupiers, land development funds, commercial investments, or multifamily, these guys got you covered.
And they recently obtained their CMHC correspondent lender status.
So for all your commercial lending needs, visit them at impactcommercial.ca.
That's impactcommercial.ca.
Attention realtors, homebuyers, and investors. If you missed out on Atlin at Clayton Crest by Zentera Developments, here's your second chance.
Atlin sold 80% in just 3 months, Adam. And because of that success, Zentera is launching Building 2, Butte.
Located in West Clayton and walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, prices are still low for now, but not for long.
Homeowners across the Lower Mainland are using equity from their current homes to invest in West Clayton, ahead of the SkyTrain and the next market upswing, because when that SkyTrain is complete and the market rebounds, it'll be too late.
This, Matt, is how wealth is built. Find out why Atlin sold so fast and register now at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
All right, so we're here today with Ryan Wong and Tony Liu of Wong and Liu Evaluation Group. How are you guys doing today?
Great. Thanks for having us on the pod here, Corey.
Absolutely. So first off, I think we should say, Ryan, we've had you on before, but at a previous company, you've now partnered with Tony. You guys have launched Wong and Liu Evaluation Group. Tell us how that happened. Like, how did this all come about? Because now you guys have your own brand new firm, and congratulations on that.
Oh, thanks very much. We opened the doors October 1st, so just over about a month ago now. In my old role, which I had been with the firm for about 27 years, for the last 10 or so, it felt like I was operating as sort of a business within a business, just managing my own clients. So a natural progression just seemed like to be to open my own shop. And Tony, so here we are.
Congratulations on that. Well, like I said, Ryan, we had you on before, but Tony, I'll put the floor out to you there first, then we'll go to Ryan after. Tony, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you got into the appraisal side of the business?
Yeah, absolutely, Corey. So I've been working in the commercial real estate valuation and consulting field for just over a decade now. And I kind of began my career with the legacy BCS Real Estate, where Ryan actually hired me back in 2015. And in the last 10 years, I gained experience across a wide range of asset classes, like anything from mixed-use development sites to master plan communities to IPP properties, such as retail, office, industrial use. And over time, I just found myself increasingly drawn to more complex assignments, projects that sit at center stage, right? Planning and financial feasibility. Also, a significant portion of my work has also been focused on the property assessment appeal side of things, where I collaborate with property owners, developers to challenge and reduce assessments. And in the past year, you know, these efforts have led to multi-10-figure reductions in aggregate assessed values, which has been a rewarding experience and something I'm grateful to have achieved for our clients.
And Ryan, tell us more about yourself. We know you've been on the podcast before, but for those listeners who may not have heard the episode, tell us more about yourself and your background in the appraisal business.
Yeah, so I started at the old BCS right out of school, at a UBC commerce graduate back when they called it urban land economics. I sort of started working on feasibility studies on condo projects and mixed use projects throughout the West Side and the downtown core. And, you know, it was an exciting time in the real estate market. And over time, I worked on a variety of asset classes similar to Tony. So I've done it all. So retail, office, industrial, multifamily land. And in my most current role, I sort of originate work, prepare evaluations and oversee other associates' work as well. And it's still a wide range of asset classes throughout the province.
One reason why I want to have you guys on the program today is in the appraisal business, you're kind of on the front lines of what's happening. You're seeing values, you're seeing what is selling, you're seeing what's not selling. How have you guys, how has 2025 been in your guys' viewpoint? Obviously, going into 2025, a lot of people had very high expectations. And then our good friends down to the south, Mr. Trump, thought he'd throw this word called tariff out there, and it felt like the world hit a brick wall. But what have you guys seen on the appraisal side of things over the past, we'll call it 11 months now that we're recording this on Halloween?
Yeah, for sure, Corey. Ryan, I'll just jump in first. I think on the development landscape, Corey, it's still relatively soft. I think, you know, 2-3 years ago, back during COVID, master plan communities are probably the most sought after development site classes. But now that that kind of market has evaporated and, you know, obviously financing has been tough for development sites and anything that kind of transact, like kind of have to have income in place. One example I kind of gave out is if you look at the Broadway corridor, where sites were being done between $180 to $200 per billable 2-3 years ago, you're probably looking at $100 today, if even that, right? And I do think sites that do transact in the corridor in the next year or 2 years, it's probably going to be driven on income instead of land value.
Now, with that Broadway, because that's a great example there. Is there anything in particular that you feel, besides maybe market conditions, that's impacted that Broadway plan? It is probably a contentious point when talking to developers there, but I'm curious to get your guys' thoughts because you guys are seeing the appraisal side of that project or that corridor.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you look at all the proposed projects and when developers underwrite these sites, most of them underwrite it on a rental basis. So the 80-20 market and affordable rental designation on the Broadway corridor. And, you know, back then when they were paying $190 to $200 per billable, rents were increasing by 5 to 10% per year. And these developers underwrite these sites on a 10-year discounted cash flow basis. So they're essentially growing the rents from, you know, anywhere from 3 to 5% per year to get to the $200 available. But if you look at the last 24 months, rents are actually dropping. Right. And I think we're continuing to see rents drop and soften in the last, you know, 6 to 12 months. So a lot of these feasibility and residual models are no longer feasible because the moment you can't grow your rents in your pro forma, there's really no value to the land.
Correct. Now, if we take it here by that's a great example of an area that I think feels like, do you mind if we kind of walk through maybe asset class by asset class and I'll just leave the floor open. You can throw out your thoughts of what you guys have seen over the past 10, 11 months here. So maybe we'll just lead it to purpose-built rental coming off the development land there. How has that market been impacted? What have you guys seen over the past time period with regards to like a multifamily side of things?
I think on the purpose-built rental side, Corey, if it's well-positioned, well-located assets, they still do achieve that premium in the marketplace. And one site I can think of is this property in Kitsilano that recently sold as a brand new, I think it was 50 or 60 unit property, fully leased up. And I think they sold at just over 4 cap, which is actually not too different from, you know, 24 months ago, right?
Yeah.
But I do think properties outside of Metro Vancouver, let's say if you're in more of a suburban location, those will likely have a bigger impact just because the rents are, the decrease in rents are more substantial than, let's say, you know, in Kitsilano or in along the Broadway corridor.
Ryan, what have you seen in multifamily? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I would say that there's definitely stable cap rates despite declining rents for the well-located trophy assets. That won't really change. Rents are coming down. Your price per square or price per unit is probably going to come down a little bit. The cap rate seems to be holding steady, but rents would have been higher to support those same cap rates, call it 18 months ago.
Now, with the multifamily side, obviously it's been challenged. I think Airbnb has probably been something that's probably plagued that, maybe in a lot of these secondary markets as well. Is there anything in particular besides market conditions that you guys have seen or been able to reference that maybe is impacting the multifamily market, maybe immigrate or maybe like immigration right now or anything like that?
Yeah, I would point to immigration, the flow of students coming into the region having slowed down, that and Airbnb just say has returned a lot of product back to the long-term rental market that we hadn't seen before.
Now, if we shift our thoughts from multifamily, we'll save retail to the end. I think that's probably the obvious winner in the thing. What have you guys seen on the office side with regards to transactions? We are hearing and we are seeing a little bit through the brokerage community that office is kind of becoming more on the long-term radar, but the phones are ringing. What have you guys seen on the office side of things over the past year?
I would say from our perspective, the office market, it almost operates in a couple of main and broad generic sort of classes. One would be the institutional sort of arena, where you have buildings like 700 and 750 West Pender, you know, at the 100 plus million dollar region, being sold at a mid to high six cap. But then you've got like the sub $30 billion assets, which are more, I guess, geared towards the private investor. And those operate at different cap rates. And they're going to be, you know, probably 150 points below that, right? But it's different price point, different buyer. But there is an active market for both asset classes right now.
Are you guys seeing an increase in stuff that's coming across your desk there with office looking for appraisals or valuations on them right now?
I mean, there's always a valuation work done, being not just on a transactional basis, but just that constant churn of refinancing mortgages. We do a lot of work with family offices, and they're always evaluating their own portfolios for strategic decision making. So there can be any number of reasons that would trigger that appraisal process.
Now, can we maybe we'll cut into what we're talking about there? Maybe we can put some light on there, because I think a lot of people think in the public's eye that someone buys a property, whether it be residential or commercial, and they get an appraisal done, and that's what the appraiser does. But I think there's so much work behind the scenes on the appraisal side of the business that you alluded to right there that maybe the public doesn't understand. Can you maybe discuss more what type of appraisal work besides a condo to purchase and sale that you guys do behind the scenes?
Yeah, Tony, if you want to take that one.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Corey, we do quite a bit of work on behalf of clients, more both on the legal side of things as well as for taxation purposes. So one thing I can draw on is in recent years, we have been kind of been retained to look at properties for valuation purposes, but it's actually, the report is actually going to CRA. And what our clients usually get us to do is to establish a market value of a certain date, and they will use that value with the CRA and whether or not they want to kind of write down their assets for tax planning purposes or for estate planning purposes. And on the legal side of things, both Ryan and I, we have been accepted as expert witnesses in the Supreme Court of British Columbia, whether it's within marriage disputes or, you know, asset disputes between business partners. And that's something that we've both been, that we worked on in the past for.
Tony, you said something earlier there about, you know, the appraisal side of the things with regards to the assessment side, the BC assessment side and taxation. Can you tell us a little bit more about that part of the business? Because I think that's one thing too a lot of landlords probably overlook. They don't realize that process. They look at it, if you have a true triple net leases, my tenants pay the property taxes anyways, why should I worry? But it's a very important thing, especially when the economy does start to get a little bit tighter, that having your triple net costs as tight as you can to pass those on to your tenants really important, because the tenant just writes you a check. They don't care where you put it. So maybe challenging some of those BC assessment reports. Can you tell us a little bit more about that part of the business?
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head, Corey. So, you know, I think with tenants, all they really care about is the gross rent that they pay, right? So whatever dollar per square foot they're paying, inclusive of CAM and taxes. And if we could negotiate so the property owner pays a lower property tax, you know, in essence, they could increase their net triple net rent and therefore adding value to the property as a whole. And in terms of the assessment cycle, it's actually pretty nuanced and pretty complex because BC assessment, you know, they take market value just as one aspect of the assessment rationale. So I'll just quickly walk through the process with BC assessment. So in early January, the property owners get the assessment notice from, you know, BC assessment, and property owners have until end of January to file an appeal. And that kind of goes on through the spring up until April. So that's the first level of appeals. And if there's no kind of result from that, then we will have to file an appeal to the property appeal panel, which is what we call PAP panel. And that could go on until throughout the summer. And with regards to the Assessment Act, it's pretty nuanced in the sense that they are updating the Assessment Act, and there are case law and precedent that we kind of have to draw from. So in recent years, not only do property owners have to pay property tax, their site could also be subject to additional school tax, vacancy and speculation tax as well.
Now, my question is, like, how many clients probably should look at this, just as a broad stroke, I guess, understanding your portfolio would dictate this, but how many clients should probably like take a look at those property assessments regarding on an annual basis? I'm sure it's an overlooked part of most people's business.
Yeah, we do think every property owner should be aware and should audit their assessment notice in every January. There are things on the assessment notice that's not very clear. So we would often get our clients to send us a copy of their assessment notice when it comes in. So an example I would give you, Corey, is let's say if your site is designated for additional school tax, the assessment notice doesn't actually tell you outright. They don't say on the assessment notice that, you know, you will have to pay additional school tax. There is some language on there that we could kind of derive from whether or not you could be subject to additional school tax. But really, the property owner doesn't know until they get their tax notice, you know, in May or June of every year to know if they have to pay additional school tax. And if you were to look at the additional school tax rate, it applies to all properties above $3 million. So between $3 and $4 million is an additional 0.2%, and above $4 million is an additional 0.4%. And effectively, you know, if your property is assessed high enough, you're essentially paying double the tax rate as if you're a typical class one residential property.
And for that, is there any areas or regions where you find that more common?
Yeah, so it applies to all properties, all residential properties assessed above $3 million. So I would say, you know, bulk of the properties in Vancouver on the west side, on the east side, would trigger additional school tax. The unfortunate thing is in recent years, that tax has also applied to development sites. So if you do have a vacant site that's zoned residential, or if the proposed development is for residential development, you will likely have to pay additional school tax up and beyond your typical class one residential tax rate.
Thanks, Tony, for unpacking that too. Like I said, I think a lot of people overlook that as part of their portfolios. And I can tell you just from past experience with properties that we have, we've looked at this on various things and we've been successful in getting some of these things down, including one, this could be more commonly seen now than ever, is we had a retail plaza that had about 73% of the retail plaza, well, almost 8,000 square feet, was a daycare. So when that was brought to our attention, we looked at it and we were successful getting that changed. The class changed on it, which reduced our property tax on that property, I think by like $7,000 a year. So it was pretty significant for those tenants. Ryan, I'm gonna throw it back to you here and we'll continue down the different asset classes. We talked about office. We've talked about multifamily. Industrial. Industrial, I think, was the darling of our industry for a long period of time, probably the better part of a decade now, where it felt like if you build it, they would come. And projects were selling out, prices that were going up. Everything was working in the favor, but we've obviously seen that side of things come to a slowdown. What have you guys experienced or seen on the industrial side of it, whether it be a sale, refinance, or even new development stuff?
So early on in the pandemic, I would say that industrial was the darling among asset classes for investors. And they did well early on with industrial because everyone was looking at e-commerce and distribution and warehousing as online shopping was increasing. And that drove rents and land values up. But I think we've definitely, we have definitely stabilized and normalized, and values have come down across the board, whether it be for rents, strata values, and land values, as well as absorption levels.
And Ryan, what have you, I'd be curious here, because industrial for the longest time, whether it was small bay strata, medium bay strata, large bay strata, or even freestanding buildings, it had the largest percentage of owner occupiers in it. Have you seen a shift in that in any way, whether in more investors, less investors? What have you guys seen? What's coming across your desk?
I mean, historically, industrial and office strata has really appealed to the owner user. And that continues to be the trend right now. Yeah, that's been our experience.
Okay, so we've covered off industrial. Actually, I'm going to go back one step. A part B to that question there. Do you see a recovery in the industrial side of things? Or is there a trend that you're seeing? And if so, how long does it take before that asset class kind of gets its footing again?
I'm not sure if we'll get back to the days of those peak land values on the industrial side. In my career, I had not seen land values ever rise to those levels that we saw. So I'm not sure that we'll see that again. Tony, I'm not sure if you're seeing anything else in the work that you're doing, though.
Yeah, Corey, I would think for the industrial market to recover as a whole, we'll have to see strata values and lease rates recover first. And I do think industrial land is often, like land in general, is often a lagging indicator of where the market is.
Yeah.
So if we don't see industrial strata projects have a successful launch, or if lease rates don't recover to where they are maybe like 18 months ago, I would think the industrial land market will just take longer to recover. So for example, if you look at Richmond, back in 2021, 2022, like industrial land was going for $8 million to $9 million an acre. And the deals that we've seen from our clients, you're probably at half that rate. Today.
Wow. No, I think we all would agree that that run that it had, at least on the land side of things, just almost felt unattainable long term with how things were moving so quickly. And obviously, I think no one kind of saw what 2025 was going to bring, at least not at the start of the year, that's kind of really, really kind of pushed that back. I think another thing too that I would comment on that is it feels like the leasing market of industrial obviously feels like it's plateaued or even come down, that paying $700 a foot for a strata industrial property when I could rent it for $18 or $19 or $20 became very, very tough for a lot of owner users to be able to pay the difference to be an owner in it versus how you could probably rent them now at a cheaper rate and maybe get a little bit more inducements from a landlord than we may have saw over the past few years. So it'll be interesting if that trend continues. We've kind of covered a lot of them there. I think I'm going to ask, I'm going to save retail to the very end. But I think I'm going to ask something that we know the answer to. But development land, that was something that if we go back to pre-2020, was a big, big part of the commercial real estate industry. What have you guys seen on the development land side? I'm very curious. I can only imagine you're doing a lot of appraisals right now, maybe on behalf of lenders, trying to figure out what their land's worth that they're taking back. But what have you guys seen on the development land side of things? If anything at all, that is.
I mean, as for development sites that I appraise, I would say a very small proportion of it relates to transactional activity where someone's buying a piece of development land and acquisition financing for it. I mean, we're still pretty active in purpose-built rental development land valuations. And I would say that's still the busiest asset class for me, at least.
Tony, what are you seeing? Are you seeing anything different out there? Because it is one that we all would agree has been probably extremely challenged as of late.
Yeah, I would just echo to what Ryan said earlier. I think for development sites or sites with redevelopment potential to transact today, they would have to have some form of holding income or income in place, or else I think there's very little liquidity in the market for that asset type.
Thanks, Tony, for that. Now, I saved retail to the end. I'm not saying because it's my favorite, and I'm not saying because we were promoting this years ago, but retail. Everyone seems like they're looking for the same retail, whether it's value add, whether it's well-positioned, grocer anchored. I can only imagine that you guys are seeing a lot more retail assets than any other asset come across your desk right now. And I would also like to think that those retail assets are probably trending upwards when most aren't. Am I correct in assuming that, or are you guys seeing something different?
I mean, I'm pretty active in the high street front retail landscape. pretty active in the markets like West 4th, South Granville, pockets of downtown. And I would say that cap rates have been pretty stable around below 4% region the last couple of years.
Yeah.
But the days of paying a 3 cap with upside, those don't seem to be here. And I'm not sure when they'll ever return. The higher price stuff, if you want to point to Shangri-La downtown or the Winners building, I mean, elevated cap rate, but it's a different kind of buyer, right? A different risk profile, liquidity's different. But those asset classes are also busy.
Now, you mentioned the Winners building downtown. I'm assuming you're talking about the property at Granville and Robson Street that transacted on there. That's, I would say, maybe unique in today's world. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that? Obviously, you don't have to comment on the transaction for things that you're not aware of, but that's a property. And for those listeners that may not know, it's a 3-story building that's got retail on grade, Best Buy, the former Future Shop on the second floor, and Marshall's now on the top floor, formerly Winners. Something like that to transact that I'm guessing, and I'll be the first to say I'm not privy to the leases, is there's got to be some long-term leases, I would think, in place with no demo clauses with those type of tenants, but then there's probably a lot of development upside. So how does something like that pencil in today's world?
It's got to be mostly yield-driven, you know, looking at the strength of the covenant, the length of term, and conversions within those leases, and you know, what sort of vacancy there might be, and any other risk factors that might be in that tenant room.
Now, purely just asking for a friend, because this is my view, I overlook that building. There's no developer that's behind that acquisition that you're aware of, is there?
Not to my knowledge.
Perfect. My sight lines, my view cone is protected. I literally overlook that building on a daily basis. So I was very curious. I hadn't bugged the agents involved to find out what happened, but great to hear. So we got retails heading in the right direction. Now, you know, I'm going to ask you to pull your crystal ball here. It's October 31st. It's Halloween. We know the Jays are winning the championship tonight, so I'm not going to ask you about that. But what does 2026 look like in your purview with regards for what you've seen over the past 10 months? Are we going upwards? Are we trending in the right direction? We just had interest rates come off 25 basis points. What does 2026 look like for you guys? And we'll start with you, Tony. Let us know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, absolutely, Corey. I think, you know, if we could get another 25 bips from the Bank of Canada by December, I think that would alleviate some of the stress in the system. And we would probably plateau in terms of where we are, meaning that I hope there's not going to be any more downside potential and we just trend where we are. But I do think for things to recover, we're probably looking at, you know, 2 to 3 years out, just because if you just look at housing starts, right? Like there's really no new projects in the pipeline that's coming online today. And we really don't feel that until, you know, 24 to 36 months out.
Ryan, what are your thoughts on how 2026 look?
I mean, most of the people that I speak to, I think, would agree that 2025 has been a challenging year. And I think most would feel that 2026 will probably be similar. So I'm not sure that I would be the glasses half full right now going into next year.
Well, I'm going to go the opposite direction because that's the business that we're in, is we're going to be very optimistic that 2026 is going to have a turnaround, but I don't disagree with any comments that you guys have made. Deals have been fewer and far between with it, but good things like retail acquisition side of things tend to move really quickly. And I can say from a brokerage standpoint, we saw a turnaround, at least in our business, May, June, and it's been like a hockey stick up from there. But that is also coming on the heels of not a lot of transactions January through May. So we're all hoping and trending in the right direction there. Guys, before we let you go, I appreciate you guys taking the time to come join us here. We do have a 6-pack of lighthearted questions we ask everybody. You guys have a few more minutes to stick around for us?
Absolutely.
I'll break this up. We'll do 3 and 3 to make it real, real quick here. So, Tony, I'll start with you. You've unfortunately done something horribly wrong. You found yourself on death row, but you're allowed to have one more meal before they pull the plug on you. What meal are you having?
I would say it would be my go-to 16-ounce ribeye steak at the Keg with fries as the side.
You know what it is? Honestly, we've done this podcast, I think, 3+ years now. And I don't think we have anyone say the Keg yet when we ask a question about that. I have to agree with you. The Keg is my go-to. It's my all-time favorite. You know what you're getting. And you're also not going to be walking out with a second mortgage on your house for a family of 4. So I agree with you on there. That's a great one. Ryan, question's over to you. You're sitting on vacation. You've had a few too many beverages and someone gives you a karaoke mic. What song are you singing?
Corey, I love 90s R&B, but I've got way too much respect for my R&B idols to butcher that. So I'd probably take it as a cue to go up to the bar and grab another drink.
Tony, I'm going to throw this one at you as well then. What song are you singing if you've got a karaoke mic in front of you after a couple beverages?
I would say it would have to be one of the Backstreet Boys tracks. It could be any one of those.
You know, I appreciate your honesty. So I'm gonna age myself here. I was born in 1983, so I'm 42 now. I was in high school when the Backstreet Boys were big. And everyone, I think, listened to them. No one wanted to talk about them, but they didn't sell 10 million CDs by accident. So I think anyone that could not grab a mic and do a Backstreet Boys song would be lying to themselves. I'm going to give you a good one on that one. All right, Tony, next question up for you here. Something that you've purchased for $1,500 or less has had a positive impact on your life lately.
I wouldn't say it's a recent purchase, but I got our standing desk for the office maybe like 7-8 years ago for under $1,000. And that was by far the best purchase.
Good answer. Good answer. Ryan, you're a hockey guy. I'm going to throw this one out at you. We're here October 31st. We're about a month into the season. Do the Canucks make the playoffs this year?
Oh, I'm going to come off as sounding so negative on the pod here, but no, I don't think so.
No. Kelly, I'll ask you a follow-up to that. Pettersson over under on 80 points this year.
Jeez. Under for sure.
Under for sure? Okay, well, that's not looking good here for our Canucks. Tony, next question up for you. Favorite vacation spot when you find the time?
It would have to either be one of the Hawaiian Islands or Japan. And anywhere in Japan would be good. Hokkaido is great, especially in the wintertime if you're a big snowboard or a skiing fan. But either way, yeah.
Awesome. Good choice. Ryan, last question up. You talked about 90s rap there. Favorite band or musician?
Well, my friends and I just bought tickets to a concert. It's a New Edition, Boyz II Men. So that's got to be top of my list.
Top of your list there. Good, both good choices. Guys, thank you so much for taking the time to come join us today here. But how can more people find out about Wong and Liu and your new company and your valuation and the appraisal business you guys have? How can we find out more about it?
You can visit us at wlvaluation.com. Find both of our email addresses there, but send us a note anytime.
Amazing. Guys, well, thank you very much once again for joining us today. We really appreciate it. I'm sure we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much, Corey.
Thanks for having us, Corey.
Thanks, guys. There you have it, folks. Our interview today with Ryan Wong and Tony Liu of Wong and Liu. I thought it was a great, great opportunity to really pick their brains to sort of see what is going on in the marketplace, as there's a ton of work that they alluded to that they do on the evaluation side that is not tied to a condo to purchase and sell. Tony also had a chance to sort of dive in there a little bit on how they can challenge the BC assessments part, which on the program we talked about how it can be a overlooked part of a lot of people's portfolio, especially if you have a piece of land that's in a developing area. There may be a new OCP attached to it. Lots of different ways that you can relook at that. So great episode. A lot of good insight for 2025. We're looking forward to next week. Another great episode coming your way, guys. Thank you very much for listening. Take care.
Subscribe today.